Have you ever applied a skincare product to your body and wondered what kind of crazy chemicals are in it, and then read the ingredient list and realized you can't even pronounce half the ingredients? Your skin is the largest organ of your body, and what you put on it becomes part of you. In fact, if your skincare has chemicals you wouldn't eat, you probably ought not rub it all over your body. This is why in our house we use Tallow Skin Solutions Body Butter. It is made with all natural ingredients that are safe enough to eat and offer your skin the nutrients it can thrive on. The tallow is sourced from a family farm in Georgia, which practices sustainable regenerative agriculture. The body butter also has organic coconut oil, organic cocoa butter, and organic essential oils. The texture is silky and luxurious as it is whipped to the perfect consistency. Enjoy one of the five different scents. My personal favorite is creamsicle, which blends vanilla and orange and smells delicious. If you've never used a natural product like this, you are in for a treat. Go to tallowskinsolutions.com and enter code MINDFUL for 20% off. That's tallowskinsolutions.com and use code MINDFUL for 20% off your next order.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to the Mindful Movement Podcast. I'm your host, Les Raymond. Thanks for tuning in for another episode. Today, I speak with Spencer Feldman about detoxification. Now, on my health journey, I've tried a lot of detox products, and some of them have been really useful, and some of them not so much, maybe even harmful. I've probably got in my own way a few times along the journey. Now, what we talk about today is going to be not medical advice. Let me make that clear. I am not a doctor. And if you feel like you have something in your body that needs detoxing, I do recommend working with someone that is skilled at guiding people along that journey. So seek a medical professional to do so. But I also am a proponent of tinkering around, trying things, and practicing listening to your body and seeing what works and what doesn't. That being said, Spencer is involved with creating a lot of products that help people get stuff that's inside the body that you want out, and seems to have a lot of experience about that. And I'm always looking to learn more about detoxification because from what I understand, it's kind of an uphill battle. I think our environment has a big burden that it puts on us, whether it's through our food supply or our air quality or water quality. And all kinds of environmental stuff. So I think it's important to shine a light on the idea and be mindful as when we're figuring out how to take care of ourselves. So thank again for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy the episode. I'm here with Spencer Feldman, the founder of Remedy Link. Spencer, thanks for joining me on the Mindful Movement Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Les.
You seem to know a lot about detoxification. I've been paying attention to, I guess, the world of fitness and wellness for quite some time now. And detox is a word that gets thrown around a lot. And I'm definitely guilty of being a guinea pig and trying different detox fads and such. And for a while, I don't think I knew anything really about it. I would just try things, which rarely worked well. And then as I get older, I'm trying to learn a little bit more and have a more appropriate understanding of what I'm actually trying to do when I'm interacting with my body in terms of detoxification. I was hoping we could start off with you teaching us, kind of zooming out in the macro level, like what detox really refers to in the body, not from like a celery juice fad standpoint or whatever, like what's actually happening in the body when our body's trying to get rid of said toxins.
Sure. So our body has a natural capacity to detoxify for the things that we were evolutionarily exposed to, you know, spider bite, arsenic, and well water, so forth and so on. But with modern industry and the chemical revolutions, and we are exposed to a lot more than our body has a capacity to deal with. And so it behooves us to learn the ins and outs, at least the basics of what detox is. And it's a great question. So what is it? If a toxin, is water soluble, it does its damage and then it leaves within a day. You just urinate it out. If a toxin is fat soluble, though, well, there's a lot of fat in the body. All the membranes are made out of lipids, or, you know, so when a toxin's fat soluble, it can get in and bind to the fat, and then you can't just wash it away. And to illustrate this, imagine that you have a dish with some grease on it. And if you dunk that dish in some water and pull the dish out, the grease is still going to be there. But if you have add a few drops of soap to the dish water and drop the dish in and shake it around a little bit, and a lot of that grease is going to come off. What's happened is the soap engages in a chemical reaction with the grease, making the grease water soluble. And now the water can rinse it away and it goes down your sink. In essence, detox is making fat-soluble toxins water-soluble. If it's water-soluble in the first place, you don't need help. There's just the damage it does that you have to repair from. When it's fat-soluble, that's when detox comes in. So the question as someone who's doing detox is, what are the soaps I need for the various types of toxins, fat-soluble toxins I've been exposed to? And to make it easy, you don't really have to master this. There are, broadly speaking, three classes of toxins we deal with. The first would be metals. And I break that into four different categories. So we have the simple metals. If you are watching this on YouTube, open up in another window the periodic table of elements so you can kind of go along with me as I'm pointing or I'm illustrating this. So the basic metals, as I would call them, would be things like aluminum, arsenic, cadmium, barium, lead. And the soap, the thing that will render it soluble, there are a number of things you can use. I like using EDTA, ethylene diamine tetraacetic acid, which is a fancy name for something with four vinegar groups on it. Tetra is four, acetic acid's vinegar. And it's the acids that combine to these things. Now, it's some people believe that acids are bad for the body. That's not true. Stomach acid is necessary, right? So the issue with acids is you want the right amount and the right type of acids. Some acids aren't good for us. I mean, we don't want to be over acidic, but some acids are good for us. So when you exercise, you make lactic acid, and that will remove toxins. When you eat an apple, you're getting malic acid. When you drink lemon juice, you're getting citric acid. And all those are chelators, or things that can remove metals. But in the 21st century, we are exposed to so many metals that we need something a little stronger, unfortunately, than when we can get out of nature. And that's where EDTA comes in. And that can bind to those simple metals. So that's the first class of metals.
Is there, can I stop you there? So is there a natural way that our body gets rid of these that doesn't come from our food or from EDTA? We don't make EDTA in the body, do we?
No, it's made in a lab.
So what's the natural method that we would excrete a metal toxin from?
So the body does have a chelating capacity. Glutathione and certain conjugating elements can remove metals. Certain acids in your body can remove metals. We do have a limited capacity to remove metals. We are grossly outmatched in terms of what our body can do and what some of us are exposed to. So doing it naturally, unfortunately, it's just, these are orders of magnitude. It's a lovely idea and not practical.
Gotcha.
Today's world. It's very rare you find someone that has no metal exposure. They've never had mercury in their mouth. They haven't eaten a lot of predatory fish, so forth and so on. So the first class are the simple metals, and I like EDTA for that.
One more question about that. I've heard that sweating can remove some metals. Do you know if there's any truth to that?
So what metals do is they look like things we need. So cadmium looks like zinc, so it goes in the prostate. Lead looks like calcium, so it goes in the bones. Mercury looks like selenium. You'll see it in the thyroid. Aluminum like magnesium. You'll see it get up in the brain. So it's these things can get in there and hold on pretty tightly. They displace the metals that we need nutritionally, so they're actually part of us. And they can also get stuck on what are called the mineral transporters. So every cell has all of these little ports in them. Some of them are like revolving doors. Some of them are like pumps. But there are ways of bringing things in and out. And the metals will go in there because they're the right size to the things we need, but there are different electric charge. And so they can get stuck in the transporters. And that's the equivalent of someone coming to your house and crazy gluing your refrigerator door down and your toilet seat down. Now you can't eat and you can't go to the bathroom. That house is unlivable very quickly. So metals can end up making it so we can't get nutrition in, we can't get toxins out, among other things. It also causes proteins in the brain to misfold, and we can get there at some point. That's the cause of most neurologic problems. So trying to get them out of the body with sweating, I think that's better for the chemical side of things. And the challenge with sweating or any of these mobilization techniques is you can end up moving them around, right? If the body has taken a toxic metal or chemical and put it someplace like the fat to keep it away from the brain or internal organs, and you sweat and you mobilize it, if there's nothing there to bind to it, some of it can come out, but some of it can also get redistributed to a worse location like the brain. So if you want to do these techniques like sweating and so forth, great, but understand that they should also be done at the same time as you use something that sequesters and binds and chelates the toxin.
I think I've been guilty in the past when I, before I got healthier really, and I was probably just generally more toxic, of being like really aggressive, trying to get them out, thinking if something worked, then more should work more. And experience that, like you're moving them around, but you're not necessarily getting them out as fast as you're like dislodging them from wherever they are and feeling really, really worse, and going through some nasty growing pains in that process, which I would assume is common. I think I remember a doctor telling me that your genetics could have a big impact of that. Like some people are just generally more or less efficient genetically of moving things out. So if you're not great at getting rid of them and you stir the pot, you could feel pretty gross before you feel better.
Yeah, there's a lot of traps and pitfalls in the detox protocols that are out there. So for instance, if someone is genetically different, maybe they don't methylate well, and or they have compromised pathways, like their kidney function's not great, then yes, if you mobilize something inappropriately, it can stay around longer and go to the wrong location. There's two ways that can happen. The first is the wrong chelator is used or the wrong detoxifier is used. And I'll explain this in terms of, for instance, the fourth class of metals that I pull out. And that's the things like the gadolinium, the uranium, which is actually not that rare. A lot of people have it in their well water. That's where radon comes from. So for instance, when we're talking about detoxifying certain metals, there are two ways to go about it. There's two types of chelators. One is linear, that's like wrapping a ribbon around it. And one is macrocyclic, that's like grabbing it with claws. Now, the one where you grab it with a claw makes a much better bond to it. So you're much less likely to have it fall off. But again, it has to be a big enough claw to wrap completely around it. We have a product called Captomet that uses something called DOTA, which is the big brother version of EDTA, which has 8 coordinate bonds. So it's large enough to wrap around these really large metals. Now, if someone tries to chelate a metal with the wrong chelator, and they kind of, you know, imagine if you grabbed onto a baseball with your hand, you're gonna make a pretty strong grip, and it's not gonna come out unless you let your hand open up. But if you try to grab a basketball with your hand, it can get knocked out of your hand. Your hand's not big enough. That's the wrong thing to grab onto a basketball with, right? You need it. So you would need something bigger to grab that basketball. So if someone tries to get rid of a metal or even a chemical, but in this case, a metal with something that doesn't fully wrap around it, two things happen. One, it can get knocked off in the process of trying to remove it. And now you might have taken something that was sequestered in the abdominal fat for safety reasons by the body. You mobilize it and then it lets go and it goes to the brain and now you've got a worse problem. The other thing is a toxin that is water soluble is still toxic. It's still toxic on the way out. So unless the more you sequester it, the less toxic it becomes, so that if you have something that's only half grabbing it, even if it takes it out the kidneys, that part that's still open is ripping the kidneys up on the way out. So you can go aggressively if you have the right chelator, but better to go at a rate that your kidneys can handle. But most importantly, make sure that what you're using doesn't let it go, doesn't release it again. And that's what happened for you. That's one of the types of detox traps that people can fall into. And there are others.
Gotcha. I've heard phases referred to, and I think I got a grip of the phase two that happens at the liver, which these fat soluble toxins are conjugated to be made water soluble. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've heard an explanation that I've understood what happens before that. So can you talk on the beginning of phase one? What's the first thing that happens and what's the importance of that leading to the next phase?
Sure. So far we've been talking about metal toxins and the chelators for those. The way in which chemicals come out, it's a different method. Okay. It's actually a two-step, there's two soaps. Right. So if chelators is a one soap, the metal for metals, for chemicals, it's a two-step process. And many of you may listening to this may be familiar with what has been used for the first part, phase one, which is a coffee enema, which is where you take coffee and you take it rectally as a retention enema. And the coffee stimulates phase one. Phase one is something technically called cytochrome P450 enzymes. And what it does is it takes the chemical toxin and it either adds on or unmasks a polar group. So basically it either adds a grappling hook to the chemical or makes available a grappling hook that was there but wasn't able to be used. Now, in that split second, that chemical is much more reactive. And in a healthy person, a microsecond, literally a millionth of a second later, a conjugating element will attach to the grappling hook. And that could be glutathione, but it could also be sulfur or methyl groups or certain amino acids or glucuronic acid. There's a number of things that the body can use depending on the nature of the chemical and the grappling hook to then make it water soluble, and then you urinate it out. Now, what can happen is there are people who don't have the phase two. Phase two is when you add the conjugating agent, and they don't do phase two very well because they've burnt that pathway out with the toxins they've been exposed to. So let's say you're in an elevator with a friend who's multiple chemical sensitivities, and a third person comes in with way too much cologne. Now you can smell the cologne and it's a little overbearing, but fine, whatever. That's because in your body, phase one put the grappling hook on the cologne inside your bloodstream, inside your body, and then the conjugating agent phase two came along. And then sometime that evening, phase three will escort it out the urine or out the feces.
So wait, that happens that fast, the phase one. So if you breathe in cologne, you're basically breathing in a chemical. But the phase one is done at the liver. Does that go from the nose to the liver that fast?
These things happen pretty darn quick.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
Now, another reason someone can react quickly is because they're actually having a histamine response to it. And we can talk about histamine detox too. So now the chemically sensitive friend who's there with you, their phase one kicks in and they put on the little grappling hooks onto the cologne, but they don't have any phase two left. They've burnt it all out. So now the chemical is actually more toxic in them than when it started because it's more reactive. Now the grappling hook can attach to all sorts of things. And so these people take toxins and make them worse in their bodies. And this is another detox trap where someone is using a detox product that hasn't been properly formulated and doesn't take into consideration that you need to support phase one and phase two at the same time. We have a product called Xenoplex. It's got both of those in there. And that's what we use with our to support people who've got multiple chemical sensitivities. So Another trap that can happen in the detox world is someone takes a product that makes them sicker and they think, oh, I'm just having a healing crisis. Or maybe their practitioner says, stay with it. You're just detoxing. If you have a reaction to a detox product, you shouldn't have a bad reaction. Most of us, 99% of us won't. It'll just be a good reaction if it's a good product. 1% of us are so toxic and so compromised that even the best detox product is still going to be a little uncomfortable as the stuff leaves. But the takeaway is each day you take it should be less and less problematic. So the first time you take it, if it's hard, take it one more day. If it's only 80% as hard the next day, good, take it again. And then it's 60% and 40%. And then by the end of the week, you're feeling better. That's your indication that your detox protocol is working. If you're taking something and every time you take it, you feel bad and or worse, then that product protocol was not properly designed for you or may actually be full of toxins. As an example, someone might take zeolite or chlorella to detoxify themselves. Well, zeolite's not made in a lab, it comes out of the ground, and that's where all the toxic metals are. So unless the zeolite you get's been acid washed first, then you may end up gaining metal toxins from the zeolite. And then if your practitioner says, wow, look at all these metals coming out in your urine. No, those are the metals the zeolite was dumping as it hit your stomach acid. Same for chlorella. If the chlorella was harvested off the coast of China or Fukushima or something, then it's gonna be full of toxins. So a detox should only make you better, or if it makes you feel worse, it's diminishing worse each time for maybe a couple of days, a week at most. Other than that, you're probably not using the right chelator or the right detox, chemical detox, or it's actually toxic on its own.
Where do you think the majority of the toxins that we have to deal with are coming from? Like, what's the most common thing that we all over?
All over the place. I mean, mercury fillings and fish are a big one. For mercury, where people work, if they're working around metals or chemicals, if they live or work near a major road, they're breathing in particulate matter. If they are
drinking, you mean just from like the car exhaust?
The car exhaust, sure. City water is a lot of municipal waters are recycled urine. And so don't have the ability. Yeah, they recycle it from the sewage system. So they, the way in which water is treated is they use flocculating agents. They put something in there to make stuff kind of coagulate and drop down. And that's problematic for two reasons. One, when you take flocculating agents into your body as a liquid, it flocculates your bloodstream and causes your blood to clot. That's not good. And the second is not all things are going to flocculate. So there's a lot of things, the antidepressants and the hormones and the cancer drugs that people are urinating out are getting reabsorbed by, from the tap water. So people are getting it from tap water and shower water. I'm always astounded. Even well water can be loaded full of uranium. So, it's a bit of...
So this is like an uphill battle. It's not something we could ever truly avoid. So it's important to... If we want to play like a bigger role in our sense of well-being, we just need to integrate into our lifestyle, like mitigation, like reduction of the intake, and just support our ability to be moving these out at a healthy way that's healthy for us. For the
I'll give you an example. Right, there was a fellow I've been counseling recently who his teeth were falling, were disintegrating, among other problems he was having. And I'm 50, 55, his teeth disintegrating. I've only seen that with radioactive toxins. And it turns out he'd been working with thorated tungsten. Now, thorium will displace calcium. So there it is, it gets in the teeth and the teeth dissolve. And he got that, from his workplace. So sure, it's important to understand where the source is coming from. If this guy had kept working there, it would have been bailing out a sinking ship, right? But on the other hand, when you go and get your oil changed, you don't say, hey, before I spend $100 on my oil change, can I spend $300 getting an oil analysis? Because that after 6 months, your oil needs to be changed in your car. So you can fairly well assume that there's some degree of metal and toxic load in your body. And it's a good maintenance thing just to try to stay on top of it. Now, some people who have really excessive toxicity, yeah, we need to figure out what's going on. Is it their well water? Is it, you know, the industry that they're working in? Or was it some previous experience that a one-time exposure that it's not going to repeat? But for most of the people listening to this, there's just this continual backlog of toxins that build up because we accumulate them faster than we can get rid of them. And at a certain point in time, the body just starts getting overwhelmed with them and starts having issues. So we need to work in a kind of maintenance detox to our lives. And even if that's just once a year where you just do, you know, some detoxes.
Yeah, I think I've heard like Ayurvedic practitioners talk about how it was in the culture. Like, I don't know if it was seasonally or quarterly that there would be practices that were just part of the lifestyle that, you know, didn't let you go too far of a run without cleaning out something.
Yeah, panchakarma, sure.
Yeah, that's the word. Which makes me think, like, how much of this comes from food? I've heard a lot of people we've had Paul Saladino on recently, you know, there's some people out there that have educated the public a lot on some of the toxins that we generally don't expect to encounter that come in food supply, especially through the plant kingdom. So I understand that a lot of plants carry with them their own toxins, which maybe at some dose could be potentially therapeutic or even medicinal. But I guess all those toxins that are just in, let's say, Brussels sprouts, do they all have to go through this phase 1, phase 2, and then excrete it out through the stool or the urine?
It really depends on the nature of the chemical. And I'll give you an example, right? In the early part of the 20th century, during the Great Depression, some think tank people got together and said, how are we going to feed all the starving poor people? And they said, well, you know, spinach is really nutritious, but nobody wants to eat it. Let's come up with a PR campaign for spinach. And that's Popeye the Sailor Man. And they were well-meaning, but what they didn't understand is that spinach is loaded with oxalic acid and causes oxalates to crystallize in the body and create kidney stones and pain in the joints and all sorts of other problems. So there are plant toxins that are acceptable at the levels that, you know, that we would eat them at. And then there's plant toxins that are useful to us. Those would be some of the bitters and essential oils, which I can talk to you about in a second. And then there's plant toxins that are from things that are fad foods that we really shouldn't be eating. We shouldn't be eating spinach unless you do what they do in India, which is you mix it with cheese, and then the calcium from the cheese bonds to the oxalic acid in the spinach and makes calcium oxalate crystals, which hopefully aren't absorbed in the intestine. So we've walked away from some of this ancestral wisdom about what foods are good for us, what aren't. And we eat these fad foods like tofu and chia seeds and things that just really don't belong in the human diet for various reasons. I mean, we could do a whole talk on lectins and anti-nutrients and so forth. But let me give you an example about, you know, the good side of toxins in plants. So have you ever had a crab apple?
I've only thrown them as a kid.
Okay. So,
and I did watch Popeye, by the way, as a young child. I remember watching that. That was like one of the, I don't know, Saturday morning cartoons I watched. So you're saying that show was like propaganda?
Well, it was well-meaning propaganda. They weren't trying to manipulate, you know.
Like they didn't know the harms of it?
I don't think
the harms of the spin.
Okay. They meant well. So 2000 years ago, grapes and apples were very bitter, right? An apple was a crab apple. Grapes were very bitter. And they weren't as sweet, right? But we like sweet foods and we prefer not to eat bitter foods. So 2000 years of selective breeding, and now we have these things that are quite different. Our food, our fruits and vegetables are very sweet, which leads to diabetes and a hyperactivity of the growth of bacteria and things. And they're don't have very much bitter elements to them. Now, the bitters are the medicinal side of things. Yes, they're toxic, but they're toxic more to the bugs than they are to us, if you get the right kind of bitters, right? So what bitters do is they interfere with what's called quorum sensing. Now, when bacteria and fungi are growing in the biofilm in the body, they act as a superorganism, and they communicate to each other, and they all take a vote about what they should do. Should we grow? Should we shrink? Should we colonize? Should we go to sleep? And they do this by kind of creating chemicals and then tasting the chemicals around them. And then based on the type and the number, they all make a decision. You can use bitters to interfere with that process and throw them out of whack, and throw them off. So eating bitters is actually a good thing. And you know, the whole sweetest bitters phenomena where, you know, people recognize bitters were medicine.
Spoonful now, of you sugar. See bitters often in like tinctures. Do you think, so when you take a bitter in a tincture, is that like have the essence of what you need without as much of the like the toxic material, or do you think it's better to actually like cook a bitter green or make a tea out of it?
Okay, so I have a product called Zoibin where we chose some bitters and essential oils, and I'll tell you about the essential oil part in a second. It depends what bitters you use. Right? Not every bitter thing is good. Some bitter things are deadly poisonous. Some bitter things are psychoactive. Some bitter things are medicinal. So I chose gentian and berberine, which are two of the most bitter things known to man. And they're also quite good for you in the mix I made. And then the other thing is, in addition to not getting bitters, we also don't get essential oils. Now, I see that you probably get essential oils in your diet because of all the greens I'm seeing in the background. You're growing a lot of stuff. Now, if you're growing any medicinal herbs there, or just spices, if you grow oregano or rosemary, you know that fresh spices taste very different from stuff in a store that's been irradiated and oxidized and sat in a bottle for 6 months before you got it. Unless you pick your spices fresh from a raised bed outside your kitchen window, there's no essential oils left. Now, essential oils are how plants defend themselves against the same things we have to deal with. It's how they defend themselves against cancer and viruses and fungus and parasites and bacteria. And it helps break down the biofilm so that the body can get in to go after these infections. So, you know, we don't eat bitters and we don't eat essential oils anymore. So I made a product that's got like five edible essential oils out of the hundreds and hundreds that are out there. There's only a few you can actually eat that won't hurt you. And then two of the bitters. And then the idea is we're recreating what you would be eating in ancient Greece, right? Or, 2,000 years ago, that would be part of your diet. So yes, not all bitters are, you know, plants. It takes some sophistication to understand plants because there are things you want that you're not getting and things that you get that you don't want.
Where did you learn about the plants and like the different essential oils and different bitters?
Well, sure. So it's what I did with once I formulated the idea that I wanted to get bitters and essential oils back in my diet. For the essential oils, I bought the textbook of essential oils, which is like 500 page book. And I went through every single essential oil that was available to man. And anytime I saw something that was mutagenic or tetragenic or, you know, hepatotoxic or caused any kind of problem, you know, put a mark through it.
And what's tetragenic? What is that?
I believe tetragenic is it's going to cause problems with the fetus, if I recall.
Okay.
I could be wrong. It's been a while. So after a few days of going through that book, I was like, gosh, you know, am I going to find anything in here? Right. And I found like four or five of them that actually you could take without having long-term sensitivities that were actually good for you and were generally recognized as safe. And then so the same for the bitters, right? You look up online, what are all the bitters? Look at all the bitter medicines that are out there and which are the ones have the least or no side effects. And it was berberine and gentian were the ones I picked.
So I've heard that bitters stimulate, I don't know if it's bile production or the movement of the bile from the gallbladder. I assume that the bile is one of the soaps that you were going to, or detergents, whatever that you were mentioning or alluded to earlier. There's a relationship there though, right? Between the bitters and bile somehow.
Yeah. So we actually have bitter receptors all throughout our body, not just our mouth. So bitters play a very ancient and powerful role in our metabolism and our homeostasis. To remove bitters from our diet is changing the way in which we've evolved and what our body's expecting, right? So we use bitter substances and we pull them and bring them in all sorts of places. But one of the things indeed is it will stimulate bile, and bile is there to stimulate peristalsis. It kills parasites. It regulates the gut microbiome. It helps emulsifies fats. And here's something else that bile does. In a healthy person, a little bit of bile will get in the bloodstream and it will solubilize the toxic fats in the arteries. So it's a natural arterial cleanse. So there's two things that we do regarding bile. Have you ever heard of a liver gallbladder flush?
Yeah, like with the malic acid and the Epsom salt, or I don't know how it all works, but yeah, I've heard.
Okay.
There's like a bajillion videos on YouTube if you are searching detox stuff.
Yeah. So a liver gallbladder flush, basically what it is you're taking, you know, an enormous amount of olive oil along with Epsom salt and the olive and some kind of acid. The acid will hopefully soften some of these stones. A lot of us are walking. If you do an ultrasound of 100 people in their gallbladder, you're going to see stones and sludge in a number of people. It happens. So what happens is, you know, you kind of you prepare the stones by softening them up with apple cider vinegar or phosphoric acid or something. And then you're going to drink the apple cider, the olive oil, and the Epsom salt. The olive oil causes the gallbladder to spasm, try to dump all of its bile to deal with the oncoming oil. And the Epsom salt dilates the sphincter of Oddi, which is this circular ring muscle at the base of the gallbladder, to open it up. So you can do this. A couple of issues with it. One, because you're squeezing and pushing so hard, you could end up jamming a gallstone into the pancreatic duct or jamming some stones in a way where you end up pushing bile and backwashing it into the pancreas and causing pancreatitis and burning up the pancreas. So it's a very dramatic thing, and it has some challenges. The other is, if you know, some people are told, well, keep doing this until you stop getting stones out of you. Well, if some, you know, and then you'll hear people saying, I've done it 20 times, I'm still getting stones. No, you're not. No. What you're getting after the first or second time is artifact created by the olive oil interacting with the bile, making little green kind of soapstones. And if you grab them, you'll squeeze them, you'll see they're not hard. They're just olive oil. And so people get it thinking, I have to keep doing this because I'm still getting stones out. And this is another detox trap, because what they're doing is each time they do that, they're flushing all the bile out of their body. Now, bile is very important to the body, which is why we recycle 95% of it. But if you dump it all out, you can't recycle it as well. It's too much for the recycling system. And what happens is the liver runs out of bile and gets very dry. And then that sets a person up for gallstones and bile sludge. So it's a self-creating problem. So that's another trap. What I prefer to do with the bile, we have a product called Glytamins, which is our remake of the liver gallbladder flush. And so no, it doesn't happen in a day. It takes 10 days. But the idea is to melt gallstones and then they just pass away naturally. And unless you happen to inspect your stool, you're just to see them coming out, you just don't even notice it. I think that's a gentler, and I also believe more effective way to do it, because we're also working in the liver. Not all gallstones are in the gallbladder. They are also in the liver. So I guess you'd call them liver stones. So that's one aspect of dealing with bile. And the other, as I said, is you can actually take bile IV. 75, 80 years ago, the Germans created something called Plaquex, which was bile and phosphatidylcholine that they would do IV to flush out the arteries. Well, we made a version of that as a liposomal, and you can take it, and then the bile goes, if you can get bile into your bloodstream as it's supposed to go, then that, as I said before, is a great natural way to clean out the arteries.
And so that bile is supposed to go into the bloodstream through the small intestines as it's working its way down?
Right. So at the bottom of the small intestines, some of that bile is reabsorbed into the liver. Now, I don't know the exact pathway by which the bile gets into the bloodstream, but when it does in very small amounts, it's a soap, quote unquote, for the toxic fats in the arteries. And let me explain how that happens. Are you familiar with something called Crisco?
Yeah. It's like cooking fat or something.
Right. So they came up, this was someone just figured out that if they took cheap cottonseed oil and they and interacted it with nickel and hydrogen, which are both metals. Indeed, hydrogen gas is a metal, that it would hydrogenate the cottonseed oil and turn it solid. And that was Crisco. And it was very popular among Jewish folk because it allowed them to fry food and still follow kosher laws, because you're not allowed to mix dairy and meat if you're following kosher law. And so you couldn't fry with butter. And so Crisco became a staple in a lot of homes, you know, last century, even today. But it's horrible for you. It's a toxic fat. But what a lot of people don't realize is it's not just enough not to eat toxic hydrogenated fats. You also don't want to make them internally. So remember, that fat was turned into Crisco, that oil turned into Crisco, because it interacted with metals, nickel and hydrogen. Well, if someone's got a lot of metal toxicity in their body, their arteries will turn into Crisco. And so we have to not just remove that stuff out of the body, but you have to get rid of why it happened in the first place, which was usually metal toxicity.
I want to back up. I know I already asked a question about this, but I just want to understand a little clear with the bitters. Because we make bile to deal with fat, but bitters, when I think of bitters, I think of like leaves, plant things that I wouldn't consider to be high in fat. Why does a bitter stimulate bile? Do you know?
Like, that's a great question. I don't know. But I can tell you that there are bitter receptors all throughout the body. And if you're if you look at hunter-gatherers, there's a mistaken idea that they're all carnivore. And typically, no. For instance, the Hadza of Tanzania are successful on about 1 out of 3 hunts. So they're eating mostly plant matter, and then they feast on meat. And so the men go out hunting for the meat, and then they also do the risky thing of getting honey. And then the women are out there, going and getting the tubers and then pounding them and then preparing them. So most human food, you know, most of what you eat historically is plant matter. And then you could say that the first kind of cultivated plant we did were beans, if you want to look historically. I don't know if it was pulses or chickpeas in the Fertile Crescent. But so that was like the first crop we did. And so we started doing those. So the thing I like about beans is they're very high in the oligosaccharides and very low glycemic index. And we can talk about how that affects the gut as well. So if you are eating paleolithically, which I think is a goal, then it's a lot of plants. And just keep in mind, you know, when you go to the supermarket and get a carrot and get an apple, that's not what it was like 2000 years ago. It was much more bitter. So just by default, you were eating bitters nonstop.
And you said a product where you put bitters and essential oils together, that's like a two punch thing where you have the bitters to get the bile moving, and then the essential oils are like antimicrobial.
Well, originally, right, I didn't make it for any particular purpose initially, other than I wanted to recreate a Paleolithic diet with that. And I knew that even if I went to the store and tried to eat what they were eating, that the plants themselves had changed.
Right.
And after I did that, and I made this product without, you know, I understood to a degree what bitters and essential oils should do, but I learned a lot in the, you know, over the years of having it and people telling me what was happening for them. So I've actually, you know, learned more from people telling me, hey, I was using the Zoibin and this and that happened. I've learned as much from that as I did from the initial research of what I thought it should do. So there were a lot of pleasant surprises that came in from actually recreating an early Paleolithic diet. There's one other thing that I went along with in terms of that. And that also is, there's in your microbiome, you know, the gut bacteria, which is, you know, a lot of people think the gut's your second brain. It's actually your first brain. It was here before the brain. It was here. All the heart and the brain and all these other organs are specialized organs that were originally handled by the microbiome. The bacteria, you know, and the gut is this one long tube that was doing everything. And then we specialized out. So the way in which it's supposed to work is when you eat sugars, right? The simple sugars you digest, that's like the fruit, honey. And the complex sugars, like the carbs, you digest with enzymes. But there are these middle-sized sugars called oligosaccharides that we don't have the enzymes to break down, but they're in the food. That's what all the bacteria in your gut eat. They eat the oligosaccharides. That's also known as prebiotics. And when you eat these, they thrive and they do we could talk for hours just on the microbiome. It starts off with regulating inside the womb, the mother's microbiome generates short-chain fatty acids that modify the architecture of the brain of the fetus to make us human, to give us our intelligence. We are as smart as we are in part due to the microbiome of the mother. And then it goes on and it educates our immune system. If it weren't for the microbiome, our immune system would have a very difficult time knowing self from other and being able to unmask stealth bacteria. The microbiome is responsible for regulating your blood sugar, your hormones, your neurotransmitters, your immune system. It runs the whole show. And really all the microbiome, and the reason it's doing that is because we have evolved this symbiotic relationship over all this time. And a microbiome that helps you heal faster and reproduce more successfully and live longer allows the microbiome to be more healthy. So the healthier and better we get, the better it is for it. It's a symbiotic relationship. So the microbiome is our most ancient and powerful ally. And all it's asking is the leftovers of the food we can't digest. Problem is, we don't eat food that has those oligosaccharides in it as much. We're not eating that Paleolithic diet. So what I did is I said, okay, I got the bitters and the essential oils dialed in. How did Paleolithic men and women, what kind of prebiotics were they eating? They were eating a lot of tubers, they ate some beans, they ate a lot of raw meat, they ate mushrooms and shellfish and insects. And so I looked at the oligosaccharides that a Paleolithic person I believed would be eating from what I could research. And we made a product called Panaceum that has all those prebiotics, all those oligosaccharides in the ratio I think it's appropriate. Now, what you'll see people are doing is that they'll go out and get prebiotics and good for them, but a lot of them have one or two prebiotics in them, the cheap ones, in massive amounts. And what that can do is throw off the bacterial count in your gut because now you're feeding one species of bacteria, but not another. So that's a whole other realm of improving health is realizing that you have this guardian angel in your gut. And if you will just feed it a little bit, it will do so many things for you. It's mind blowing.
Spencer, it seems like some people do really well as they add like fibrous foods to their diet. And then some people do worse when they do that. And it seems like they thrive more on reduced fiber. Do you have any thoughts or insights why somebody would feel like they benefit when they reduce the fiber? Is that just because they have like a dysbiotic mix? And if the microbiome is not like in a good balance and you just feed it, it just grows bigger, but it's still out of balance? Like, why do some people do better and some people seem to regress when they try that strategy?
There's a couple of reasons for that, Les. One is if someone's taking psyllium, unless it's organic, psyllium is heavily loaded with pesticides because it's in some kind of loophole for like animal feed or whatever, where they can dump much more pesticides onto the psyllium than they can in the normal food supply. So the psyllium itself can be toxic. Secondly, psyllium is not a prebiotic, realistically, so much. It's going to generate an awful lot of methane. And in some people, the roughage is very irritating to the gut. So some people think that fiber is, going to feed the gut. It's not so much going to feed the gut, or certainly not the parts of the gut you want, unless you want a lot of methane and hydrogen production, which will then paralyze the gut. What it does is it gives bulk. The way I like to get fiber is through beans. And the beans I like are adzuki beans. I soak them and rinse them for a day to get out the anti-nutrients, and then I slow cook them. And there's a ratio of, like if you look, the Hadza were doing something like 100 grams of fiber a day, but they were also doing an enormous amount of physical exercise. And when I did the calculation—
Can I push back on that? Because I talked to somebody that went and stayed with them. and mentioned that we're told that they eat 100 grams a day. And what he said is they don't actually do that, that they chew on roots. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much fiber they're getting out of that. Maybe they do get some, but they're getting the water, the vitamins, the minerals, and the sugars out of it. And then they spit out the fibrous material. Have you heard about that?
I haven't, and it's a very interesting point. And so maybe those numbers are off, and what they're spitting out would be the insoluble fibers, not the soluble fibers. The soluble fibers are going to get mixed with their saliva, and it's going to go right in them.
So is the oligosaccharide, did I say that right?
Oligosaccharides.
Are those soluble fibers?
They're sugars.
They're sugars. Okay. So that's not fiber. You said it's prebiotic, but it's not
You could argue that anything that is not digestible is a fiber.
Gotcha.
You can make that argument.
Anything that we don't take in and then it becomes part of us. Anything that passes through, essentially.
To make it more clear, I would say fiber is the insoluble roughage that goes out, and the insoluble and the soluble stuff that breaks down, you could call that a prebiotic.
Gotcha.
It may not be a prebiotic you want. So granted, we know at least that even if they are spitting out half of it, they're still getting much more than we are, right?
Gotcha.
So if you were to look at the diet, I kind of aim towards the diet of late Paleolithic, when right after beans were cultivated.
But why?
So
why do you aim to that? This is an interesting question. Why pick that period? Like, if you're going back, why not go back farther?
Mm-hmm.
Or not as far. Like, why pick that period? Was that the period that we were all just like lean and like our best health? Like, do we know? Like, why not go back farther?
Because I don't want to spend 2 hours a day chewing tubers.
Okay.
Right. So if you go back farther, you're chewing tubers all day long. And if you go more recent, you're getting high glycemic grains. And so to me, beans were that sweet spot in our dietary evolutionary experience where we're not chewing tubers, but we're not blowing our
pancreas. So that's the framework. You're looking for like, what's the balance that makes sense to you? Because I've heard some people say, well, you could, in theory, just keep going back and you'll get like something that resembles a chimp or so, you know, something that just still is eating just ripe fruit all day. And before you could, in theory, go back to before we ate meat. Now, I believe that we ate meat and then that helped us become human.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like there's that nourishes. But I find it interesting picking these periods. I don't know what's right. I'm trying to figure it out. And I like to hear people's perspective of why they pick a certain period. So you do have a mental scaffolding of why you pick that period. And it offers you a food that you seem to be fond of that seems to serve you well, these beans.
Right. So again, soaked adzuki beans, they're right. So I'm trying to get something, you know, as a general rule, I'm looking for things that are low glycemic index, low anti-nutrient, as low oxalic acid as I can get. Adzuki beans do have oxalic acid.
Oh, but they're low in, adzukis are low in oxalate?
No, they do have oxalates.
They do.
So you can take oxalobacter as a bacteria and deal with that. So indeed, you know, meat plays a very important role in humanity. It definitely is an incredibly nutritious thing, right? Where we're going, in terms, when you're trying to pick a diet, there's two things you want, right? You want to, one, feel good. But also it's good to have good blood work, right? So I have the equipment here to check my own blood. I can take a few drops of blood and run it through a lab analysis in my office, and I can see where I'm at. And you know, the last time I checked just a week ago, my lipid panel was so off the chart good. I mean, it was like Olympic levels. And I don't exercise to the degree that I could justify how good my blood was. And so, you know, for me, it's working. I can't say it will for you, but to the degree that we share some basic genetic commonalities, it may. And so what I would say is, you know, when you're hacking and trying to figure out what works for you, how do you feel? What's your blood sugar? What's your triglyceride? You know, what's your albumin? What are all your proper, are your blood values looking good? You know, is your mind sharp? Is your body strong and limber? Do you need less sleep than you used to? So, you know, and figure that out. For me, late Paleolithic is where my sweet spot tends to be. I also don't eat cooked meat. All the meat I eat is raw.
Oh, that's hardcore, man.
Yeah. Okay. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One thing is, so what I do is I have ground beef and ground chicken, and I freeze it at 35 below Celsius. And in doing so, I'm killing all the bacteria, you know, mostly I'm not even worried about the bacteria, really. It's just the parasites that would bother me more. And then I thaw it out, and I eat that, you know, two to three meals a day. Now, the reason
they didn't do that in Paleolithic times, though. You couldn't freeze something.
No, they were loaded with parasites, those poor guys.
Gotcha.
Right. Okay. But they were also eating an enormous amount of bitters. So, for instance, Hadza are loaded with parasites, but they may have acclimatized to the point where they're okay with it based on their immune system and based on their microbiome and based on their diet. Right. So I am not interested in being loaded with parasites.
So you eat raw beef and raw chicken and then a healthy dose of these adzukis, your favorite beans.
Mm-hmm.
And then
I do a low glycemic grain. I do barley.
Barley. How do you prepare the barley?
Either I'll flake it and cook it, or I'll grind it into flour, and you can either add it to soups, or I'll grind it into flour, mix it with some salt and water, and I'll put it on a pan, and I'll heat it over the cast iron stove if it's wintertime, and then you flip it and you make a cracker out of it. Now, the reason I'm eating my meats raw is twofold. One, I'm getting more nutrition out of it. I'm not breaking down, you know, some of the elements that would be broken down. You know, people go out and they want to buy exosomes and buy stem cells and buy peptides. Well, they're all in the meat if you don't cook it. Okay. And the second is I tend to react poorly towards glutamate. You know, some people don't do well with MSG. I find that I'm one of those people. And as I started lowering my glutamate levels, I found that the more I lowered them, the better I felt. And so I was looking at it and I'm like, where else can I lower it? And what I realized was when you cook meat, you liberate the glutamic acid in the meat in the same way that fermenting things will do that too. But when you heat meat, you liberate the glutamic acid. And so now all that glutamate comes out at once. Now, the advantage to that is it tastes really good. Cooked meat tastes better, no doubt, right? Ground raw beef, you have to spice it. Mix in some oil and some spices to make it taste good. Other than that, it doesn't have much taste. It's like sushi. And I don't suggest just chewing on a raw piece of steak or chicken. It's much more palatable when you grind it up. In any case, what I found is that when I stopped, that I was actually getting glutamate from the cooked meat.
And what's the problem with glutamate? What does that do? Isn't that like a stimulating thing? Doesn't that stimulate like a neurotransmitter or something?
It is a neurotransmitter. It is an excitatory neurotransmitter. Okay. It turns things on, right? Glutamate's the on switch along with calcium. And what I found was that my particular body was sensitive to glutamate, and I would get too amped. I would get too edgy when I had glutamate. And so by eating the meat raw, the glutamate that I would get would be a slow burn. It would slowly come into my bloodstream because you do need some glutamate without spiking it. So you don't want to spike your blood sugar. You don't want to spike your glutamate. You don't want to spike your histamine. We can get to that in a second too. So for me, you know, the more gradual the glutamate I had in my diet, the calmer and more grounded I felt. And that was a huge jump up in my health, was getting the glutamate under control.
That's great. I want to definitely get into histamine, but before, I had one question about that. So glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter. Am I right in thinking that GABA is like the opposing force there?
Indeed it is.
Is it possible, you think? I wonder, did you ever try having the cooked meat and then supporting the GABA somehow, whether it was through, you know, like supplements? I don't know if like some of the amino acids that support that. Did you try that at all? Like balancing that out?
Sure. So GABA, if you have a healthy blood-brain barrier, glutamate can get in, can light you up, but GABA won't cross it. So you can't, unless you've got a busted blood-brain barrier, GABA is not going to make it across your blood-brain barrier.
What about the precursors to GABA or something?
Precursor to GABA would be like GHB, that old date rape drug.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Doesn't glycine and taurine, I could be totally botching this. I know people take taurine to chill out at night and help sleep. And I thought it had something to do with.
It does. GABA. It will activate the GABA receptors. But so now is where you start coming down to genetic individuality. My body. Okay. So I took GHB before it was known as a date rape drug. It was available legally. And I tried some in my 20s and I got the best night's sleep I ever had. Oh, God. I had a wonderful night's sleep. I woke up after 5 hours of sleep feeling like a million bucks. And I just, I loved this stuff. It was great. And then I found I became addicted to it. Oh, and, and not everyone gets addicted to GABA, to GHB, but some people do. And for those who do, it's worse than, I'm told, it's worse than heroin. And
so is that not available now?
Anything's available. Yeah, it's called Xyrem and they make a drug out of it. It's by prescription. Obviously, lots of things are illegal that you can get. I'm okay. Not suggesting people get GABA.
Move on.
Hang on. Let me okay. Just finish the point. So back when it was legal, I took it and I became addicted to it. Or I realized once I don't want to take it today. My body was like, no, you must. I'm like, oh my God, this is an addiction. It was two horrific weeks coming off of it. So my body, the reason I'm mentioning this, Les, is because what that taught me in retrospect was that I don't make enough GABA. And so that's why GHB was so wonderful for me, whereas for someone else it wouldn't be, because I'm finally getting high amounts of GHB in my brain and it felt wonderful. So I have a genetic flaw where I don't make enough GABA to balance out glutamate. So for me, balance means I can try to raise the GABA. It's very difficult. I just need to lower the glutamates.
Gotcha. That makes sense. That's great that you found something that works. The histamine. So histamine kind of hits me hard, because I could probably say that all the detoxification protocols that I have tinkered with really stem from me trying to fix something that is creating a histamine response.
Okay. Let me tell you about histamine, because I'm actually, I have a very dear friend who has, trying to get her fixed was what created this. So I had a friend who it turned out had a mold toxicity issue. And as I'm studying mold, I realize it's histamines. And as I'm studying histamines, I'm realizing it's amines. So I'm going down the rabbit hole. And so basically, histamine is it's both a neurotransmitter and a hormone. And most people know that it causes kind of like itching reactions, right? So in your skin, it makes you itch like a mosquito bite. It can also cause gut reactions. But what a lot of people don't realize is histamine can cause neurologic problems. There is a histamine receptor called the H3 receptor that's found in the central nervous system, which is your spinal cord in your brain. And people who have H3 receptor issues basically have an allergic brain. And this can happen to stuff that's airborne, right? So they might go to an allergist and they might, or get a blood test, but these things might be testing for the H1 and H2 receptors in the skin and the gut and the heart, and not test for the H3 receptor. And so they're told that they're not having any problems when indeed they are. So what happens with histamine is, and especially if you've got the neurologic stuff, which is the H3 receptor, is airborne stuff can get you. And that's mold. Now, 70% of homes have mold. And more than almost a third of people are allergic to mold. 80% of homes have dust mites, and a third of people are allergic to dust mites. Mercaptan is in propane. So if you cook with propane, when the mercaptan gets burned, it turns into sulfur dioxide.
Wait, can you say that again? I use propane sometimes.
So you know that smell you get it's time to replace the propane tank?
I assume that's the smell of propane.
That's right. Well, no, propane doesn't have a smell. So that's mercaptan that they put in there. Mercaptan. And what that does is if there's a leak, you'll smell it, right? Otherwise, you could have a propane leak and never know. So they stuck mercaptan in there. Okay. And when you combust propane with the mercaptan, sulfur dioxide is created. And now you're getting histamine reaction. And this is one of the reasons, or the reason why divorce happens more frequently in homes with propane stoves, because the woman's cooking and she's breathing, women, I think, tend to be a little more reactive to propane than men do. So if she's cooking over the stove and breathing in that burnt mercaptan, she's having a histamine reaction, and it's just making her brain go, if she happens to be sensitive to it, which a lot of women are, then that it's an allergic reaction in the brain, and she could get irritable or just feel not feel good. So, yes.
So the burning of mercaptan creates sulfur dioxide.
Yeah.
And sulfur dioxide triggers histamine.
Yeah.
Why does that trigger histamine? Is it just because it's like a foreign thing that we're not supposed to have?
So now we're talking about allergies, right? So hang on, there's two more and then I'll answer your question. Okay. You've got pollen. 26% of the population is diagnosed with pollen allergies every year. If 26% are diagnosed, that means more than have it. And then you've got pollution, like volatile VOCs and particulates and things like that. So basically what goes on is somehow a person's immune system is cued in to be overly sensitive to these things, right? Now, granted, nitric oxide or sulfur dioxide or particulates aren't good for us, but a little bit shouldn't create a histamine reaction. Enough of it should, because your body has to be like, hey, I have to deal with these toxins. But what happens in people who have reactions to them is they're overly sensitized. And what that means is their T cells have a memory that says, hey, when you see this in the body, this is a foreign invader, mount an immune reaction, right? So a woman who reacts to propane, basically her T cells have the memory of burnt mercaptan as a infection, and then a immune response, a histamine is released. So what happens is you get histamine is turned into, so you have the dietary amino acid histidine, and then you have the histamine decarboxylase, which is the enzyme that turns histidine into histamine. So now you've got histamine inside the mast cells and the basophils, two white blood cells. Then when they are triggered, they release by what the body thinks is an infection, but is really a dysfunctional immune allergic response. They release the histamine. And then depending on the person's genetics, it'll interact with H1, maybe they have an irritable skin, their skin starts to go into hives, or H2, maybe their heart beats high, or maybe they get a lot of stomach acid production and they start, getting acid reflux or something like that. In some people, it'll activate H4, which is the white blood, the stem cells and the bone marrow. And in a lot of people, it'll activate H3, which is the central nervous system. And the challenge, Les, is when you dysregulate someone's central nervous system, and if you go to a doctor and say, I'm having all of these experiences, they might just think that you're neurotic because they don't see what's going on. But, the kind of things that can screw up with that, you can end up with, problems with menstrual cramps, brain fog, headaches, PMS. It's hard to wake up in the morning, ADHD, the body temperature goes wacky, or it's hard to deal with when it's hot or cold, vertigo, nausea, sexual dysfunction in both men and women can cause hypersensitivity in the nerves. So what might be, a woman might not be able to enjoy sex because when she's stimulated on parts of her body, the body doesn't recognize it as pleasure, recognize it as pain. It causes all sorts of stuff. And, we have drugs for the H1 and H2 receptors. You know about Benadryl and Claritin. We don't really have drugs for the H3 receptors. So what you want to do?
Why is that? Is it just hard to? They haven't figured out how to make it.
I think the side effects are pretty brutal because now you're starting to. Okay, so what H3 does is it releases or controls the release of neurotransmitters in your brain, right? And so when your histamine in your body goes up, it activates the H3 receptor, which lowers the histamine in your brain, which lowers your neurotransmitters. It's a safety valve that says, hey, we don't want to go schizophrenic. We don't want to have our histamine reach such high levels in our brain that we go crazy, which you can do. So when the histamine reaches a certain level in the blood, the H3 receptors say, okay, back it off in the brain to balance off what's coming in the blood. Does that make sense?
A little bit.
Okay, it's coming, it's rising up in the blood, it's rising in the brain, and the HC receptor says that's too much, back it off. But if the HC receptor gets inactively activated, it backs off the neurotransmitters when they shouldn't be, right? So now we're losing access to things like acetylcholine for memory and learning, or dopamine for movement and for drive and for motivation, serotonin for happiness, norepinephrine for focus, and GABA for, you know, just being able to be relaxed and go to sleep and such. So they don't, you know, the H3 receptor drugs, there's one out there, but, you know, the side effects of the thing can be kind of brutal because you're messing around with all the neurotransmitters of the brain. Now, the H3 receptor only lights up when your histamine is really high. So you don't have to knock histamine out completely. You just have to get it within somewhat normal levels, right? So here's my protocol for high histamine, especially in neurologic, although you could use it for anything, right? The first thing I want to do is I want to suppress the excessive transformation of histidine to histamine. That'll lower the level of histamine in general, but some histamine will still be created. So then I want to make it so that the first thing I want to do is I want to get the immune system to be reprogrammed so it stops seeing common things as an allergic response. So you have to get the T cells that have been poorly programmed to change, right? Then to the degree that that is not completely successful, you want to limit the production of histidine to histamine. To the degree that that's not completely successful, you want to stabilize the eosinophils and the mast cells so they don't release histamine. To the degree that's not successful, you want to give extra enzymes like DAO enzymes, diamine oxidase, to break down excessive histamine. Of course, you can't take it orally because then it just goes in the gut and we're trying to get in the bloodstream. So what I did is I created a product that would supports the body in re-educating the T cells so that the allergic response gets properly configured, back off the production of histamine, back off the release of histamine, and increase the DAO. We make it liposomal so it goes into so the DAO hits the bloodstream. And that's what a product is called Tesamet. That's what I'm using to support people who are having histamine issues, specifically, especially if it's like mold or neurologic histamine problems.
So how does that work? So you mentioned, you mentioned a few steps there. What do you use to suppress the move from histidine, the amino acid, which is the precursor, I guess? So you said you suppress that from becoming histamine.
Okay, right. So the first thing you want to do is you want to re-educate the immune system. And I like rosmarinic acid for that.
And why is that? What is that? I've never heard that.
It's found on rosemary and oregano and thyme and a few other things. And the literature says that it will selectively generate apoptosis in the activated T cells that are dysfunctional.
Apoptosis, and again, this is another reason. It's like that's like self-destruction of a cell.
Right. You're trying to get the dysfunctional or poorly programmed T cells to take one for the team. Right. And again, you know, this takes us back to why do I like essential oils and bitters? There's a lot of things that they do that I'm not aware of. And here's one of them, right? Rosemary.
There's some wisdom in there somehow.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. So use that as rosmarinic acid. Okay. What else is in there?
So I like green tea extract. Now, the green tea extract, the EGCG, suppresses histamine decarboxylase, which is what turns histidine into histamine. You don't want to do green tea because that has caffeine in it, and that will actually increase histamine. So you just want the extract part of it.
Caffeine sounds like the fun part of it. Okay.
Well, for some people, caffeine is great because it stimulates cytochrome P450, right? So if you have someone that's toxic but has no histamine problems, caffeine's good, or depending on how you bring it into the body, right? Okay. And then to suppress the histamine release from the mast cells and basophils, I like quercetin personally.
I have had success with that in the past, but I have to say, it took a lot. I mean, I was taking a lot of quercetin to get an effect. Now, this was like at my worst. I had a head-to-toe rash, like And like histamine was just running my life. And the Benadryl, Claritins, that kind of stuff did nothing. And Western medicine had nothing but steroid for me. I mean, just no tools in the toolkit. And somebody had recommended Quercetin, but it was like, I want to say I was taking 6 grams a day.
So remember, quercetin, like the DAO enzyme, is not bioavailable, right? So it's great if you're alert. If your histamine reaction was in your gut, quercetin was great. But if you were trying to get it into your bloodstream, that's why you had to take so much, because you were only getting like 2 or 3% into your blood. Now we make it liposomally, so you're going to get most of it in your blood. So had you had an ultrasound machine and some phosphatidylcholine and the quercetin, and you mixed a batch and made your own little liposome, you would have needed far less.
Interesting. So speaking of things you make, I've been playing with a couple of the things you sent me. Mm-hmm. And for the listeners, they are what you sent me were suppositories. Mm-hmm. So, you know, not the typical administration as far as what hole it's going into, which is really not so bad once you do it the first time. So I had a question. One, why do you do that? And why do you use that method? I assume there's a benefit to it. And also, is quercetin ever used that way? Is there a way to get it into the blood? Or is the main way you do it is by putting it inside of a liposome, which is essentially what, a glob of fat? It's like making it, putting it inside fat so that somehow that gets into your blood.
Okay, so to answer your question.
Too many questions there, probably.
No, let me see if I can remember them all. Okay, so why do suppositories? Okay, so there are a number of ingredients that don't survive digestion that are typically done by IV. EDTA is one, glutathione is one, serapeptase is one. And so when you do a suppository, there's no digestive enzymes in the rectum. So it's a way of getting something into the digestive system, into the gut, where it's not where it doesn't get denatured by digestive enzymes and acids. And yes, we do have a suppository with quercetin. The endosterol, which we use to support the prostate, has quercetin in it.
And why do you have quercetin for the prostate? What's the relationship there?
Well, you know, when someone has prostate hypertrophy, there's just a lot of inflammation there.
Okay. So it's
right. But inflammation has histamine as part of that experience, part of that. So one reason a person would do suppositories would be to bypass digestive destruction of the element without doing an IV. Another reason would be location. So for instance, if you're working on the prostate, where you're right there, or if you're trying to access the liver, well, 30% of the blood flow there is for the liver is right there in the hemorrhoidal complex. So it's a straight shot into the liver if we're trying to do a liver detox. So that's why.
So it goes upstream from the rectum to the liver. There's like northbound flow there.
So a hemorrhoid, right, is a blood vessel in the rectum that, because of the back pressure and a clogged liver, kind of varicoses into the rectum. But in a healthy person, that vein is still there. It just hasn't varicosed. So there's a very rich blood supply in the rectum that goes right to the liver.
Why is that? Why do we have a connection northbound there?
That's a great question. I don't know. Right? You know, I suppose if we sat down.
You think of the rectum as pretty much an exit route.
Uh-huh. It may be there as for a feedback mechanism to let the liver know what's going on at the distal end of the colon. I don't know.
Interesting.
Now, then the other thing you asked was, so one or two, why would you do suppositories? And then there was another question that you'd asked.
It was about the quercetin. I think you already asked.
Okay, right. So, right. Quercetin does wonderfully as a liposomal. So that's a way to get that in at much less. You don't need to overwhelm it like 6 grams to get the effect if you're actually getting it in appropriately.
Funny side story on the quercetin. So I was doing this experiment with high dose. This is probably going to be too much information, but I guess later I learned quercetin is a zinc ionophore.
Ionophore.
Mm-hmm. So it, you know, where zinc goes, it goes to some mm-hmm. extent. Well, certain fluids in our body are high in zinc, and quercetin has a color to it.
I see where you're going.
Yeah. So okay. There was a period of time where I had kind of almost like a fluorescent greenish yellow. Fluid coming from my body, and it was almost reason enough to not use it, but it did work. Like the Quercetin, once I got up to that dose, it really did have a noticeable effect. Took a couple days, and it worked, but it was kind of a pain. It was like just a lot of large pills.
Well, the other thing is, you know, that much quercetin is unnatural and can have negative effects. So, you know, it's the right amount in the right location. And I'm glad that it worked for you. Did you pay a small price? You know, did you throw your liver off? Probably. Your liver had to process all of that. You know, it's probably a bit more than it appreciated for a little while.
Yeah, so, maybe. I mean, so that's a polyphenol that has to be detoxed through one of those phase two pathways, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure which one we use for that, but it's got to take up some of the real estate there.
Well, I mean, the other thing is even not so much a matter of detoxifying, but there's something called albumin in the bloodstream that does two things. It moves nutrition and it moves toxins. And if you completely load yourself up with supplements so that your albumin is completely loaded with things that you might not need, it displaces the albumin's ability to do other things. So with supplements, more is not always better. Right, you have a limited capacity to move these things around. Move the right things around.
Right. Yeah, I've probably been guilty of that. Just trying too much, and you know, when you're feeling really bad, it's like I'll do it. You get that? I'll do anything. I have to do something. Mentality.
Sure. Yeah.
And as I get wiser and more experienced, I'm a little bit more, I'd say just a little bit more cautious about that and self-aware. I still make my mistakes still. But yeah, sometimes I just don't give things enough time. So I have been playing with a couple of things. So the two things that you sent me, I know Glytamins was one of them. And the other one, I think starts with an X, Xeno something.
Is Xanaplex. That's the chemical phase one, phase two product. Yeah.
And basically you have me using one every 3 days. So every 3 days I do one and I alternate which one. I'm probably halfway through the protocol, a pack of each. Is that typically what people will need, just like a pack of each and do one course and then
for most. I mean, a down and dirty way to see how your liver and gallbladder are doing. There's a couple of acupuncture points of the foot, liver three on the top of the foot, for the liver, and then there's a gallbladder point between the pinky bone and the one next to it. And if you kind of massage on the top of your foot between the big toe and the pointer toe, work upwards towards the top of the foot between the bones and kind of really firmly push in between those bones at different angles until you get to the top where the bones meet. That's liver three. If that's sensitive, you know, it might be time for a liver flush to clean out the liver. It can be a little uncomfortable, but it shouldn't be like, ow, right? And then the same thing for on the right side of the foot, and the right foot, between the pinky toe and the toe next to it, moving up on the top of the foot between those two bones and tendons until those meet, that's the gallbladder meridian. And if that area there is really sensitive and gives you a zinger, that's a good sign. That's an indicator, such as you might want to do something to support the gallbladder. You could look at Glytamins for that one. Or both of them, realistically.
And generally, if somebody wanted to start supporting like detoxification in general better, do you think it's better to go the route of something like Glytamins or Xenoplex first, or more stimulating the bile production in the body's natural, do you go from the top down first or from the bottom up, or?
I don't think it really matters. You know, our basic detox is metacardium, that's metals. Glytamins, that's liver, gallbladder, bile, and Xenoplex is chemicals, and a different one every day. And that's sort of like the once a year flush for all the things you do. If you wanted to add in, you know, the zoibin, which is the bitter and essential oils, and the panacea, which is the oligosaccharides, you know, trying to recreate a paleolithic lifestyle, that's cool too. There is one other thing that I do on a regular basis, and for those of you who are watching this on YouTube, I'll show it to you. Here is the device, and there's a little metal clip on the back and some ports. And basically, have you ever played around with grounding before? Les?
I do. Actually, we had Clint Ober on the podcast a couple of years back, the guy that wrote that book, Earthing. So yeah, we do. Actually, we're affiliate for his products. They're great. We have the grounding mat, and in general, like, it just opened my eyes to get outside barefoot more. And that's become a pretty regular practice for me, and my daughter does it too, where you just, you know, go out in the backyard and take it in. It's great.
Yeah, I'm friends with Clint. He's a good man. I love his work. Yeah. I mean, I it's because of him that I even know about grounding. So basically, you know, when I first started grounding, I was like, okay, this is nice, subtle. I don't know if I'm feeling anything different than just the niceness of being out in nature. But I like the concept behind it. But then I thought, well, maybe if some is good, is more better. Now, often that's not the case, but sometimes it is. So let's find out. And I made a machine that would do much more, do like up to 18,000 volts. Normally out of the earth, you get 200 to 300. And I peed out the amount of crystals that came out of me was amazing. My peripheral neuropathy was 80% gone in 2 weeks. I had people passing worms in the toilet because worms really don't like electricity. Just all sorts of junk started coming out of me. And I did that for a couple of years. And then I thought, okay, I got to the point after 3 years, I didn't need that much power. You know, whatever crystals and junk, all right. So the way crystals work is, if a crystal reaches, crystals are always growing in size, and the body has a limited capacity to keep them, to break them down, depending on diet and age. But if they cross the 7-nanometer size, then they reach a point where they're very hard to break down. Past 7 nanometers, they become very, very insoluble. And then they keep growing and growing, and they crystallize, and they could be arthritis or gout or gallstones or kidney stones or what have you. Now, there's something called the piezoelectric effect. And what that says is, if you squeeze a crystal, electricity comes out. That's those little click lighters where you pull a little trigger and it makes a spark. That's piezoelectric. And it also goes in reverse. If you put electricity in, you vibrate a crystal. So if you squeeze a crystal, you get out electricity. You put electricity into the crystal, it vibrates. And I thought, well, you know, if I put enough electricity in, could I vibrate the crystals in my body down? Because we know that's how you can recover dead batteries, as you hit them with voltage spikes. So an original device was partially made because I wanted to see if I could break the crystals down to the sub-7-nanometer size so that I could then urinate them out. And I believe we were getting really great results because, you know, we could see the urine turning really cloudy right afterwards. So I did that. And then after about 3 years, I didn't need the really big unit, but I wanted to be grounded all the time. The earth gives you about 200 to 300 volts at all times if your feet are on the ground. Very low amperage with 200 to 300 volts. And, you know, how often can you be grounded? You're not grounded when you're driving your car. That's why you get a static shock when you get out on a dry day. You know, when you're sleeping, you could sleep on a grounding pad like Clint Ober makes. That's great. But what about the rest of the day when you're at your office or walking around? I wanted something where I could be grounded all the time. Are you familiar with what microcurrent does?
Yeah, I had actually some microcurrent treatments. They were really like subtle. Mm-hmm. Lay down and woman put mm-hmm. some pads on me and set them to a certain frequency, came back a half mm-hmm. hour later, check on me.
Right. So
I get super relaxed from it, like go super deep. Theta wave relaxation, the zone I like.
So microcurrent, the original microcurrent is the earth. When you've got your feet on the ground, there's a very, even though it's 200 to 300 volts, there's a very a low level of current passing through up your feet and out your head. You know, and you could say that's part of the uprising energy going up to the spine. And, you know, we could get into the esoteric aspects of that one day too. But we're meant to be in a state of constant healing. And microcurrent is that constant healing. Now, you know, we don't, unlike a camel, we can't store water, but we don't typically live in a desert. So since humans are mostly around water, you know, rivers and streams, or have access to wells, or eat food that's juicy, we don't store water because we have access to it. And if you don't get enough water, it's a problem pretty darn quick. We do have the ability to store calories because we don't always have successful hunts. So that's what body fat is. Well, we don't have the ability to store electricity because why would you just put your feet on the ground and you've always got electricity and the whole body runs, every biochemical reaction in the body has to do with electrons moving somewhere. So we're meant to have for instance, antioxidants are all electrons. All antioxidants do is transport electrons. Well, the smallest antioxidant is actually a single electron. So the Earth is the original antioxidant, and it's the original microcurrent device. Anytime you get your feet on the Earth, you are in a state of healing where microcurrent is moving. So I said, I want that. I want to be in that, but I sit, the only time you catch me sitting is if I'm eating food, driving a car, or doing a podcast. Other than that, I'm standing. I'm in my office or I'm in a car. I can't put my feet on the ground. So I said, well, the Earth is only generating 300 volts at a very low current. That's not that much. Couldn't I put that into a box? So that's what this is. This is planet in a box.
Right? So that kicks out like the equivalent current or electrons that the Earth does.
Yeah, this is somewhere between 50 and 300 volts, depending on how you set it. Okay. And if you put it in your pants, seem like a pager, it comes out of this and it's constantly going into your side. Or what you can do is you can plug it in here, and that I actually have going, maybe you can see it, there's a wristwatch right there that I've hacked, and I have a cable going from that down to a unit, and I am getting microcurrent. So
wait, if you don't use a watch, how do you attach that to your body?
So either you kind of put this on your belt and this goes against your skin and it comes out here. That's one way to do it. Or you access it through the port on the top. If I'm looking in the corner, I'm just looking at
my own. The other end of that port, the part that you would need to touch?
Oh, okay. So
what do you use on the end of the cord?
So you can use any kind of ESD, electrostatic discharge wristband, or any, you can attach it to any, as long as the metal is contacting your body. So you could have it attached to a piece of jewelry. It doesn't matter. I took a watch and I hacked it and ran it into the watch, but just because it's more comfortable to wear, but you can do it however you like. And so I am continuously getting, I'm grounded now as we speak.
Even though. Do you feel that? Is that like sub perceptive or?
Not to me, but it is subtle and not everyone's going to pick it up, but I'll give you an example, right? Women notice these things more than men. They're more in tune. And the sicker you are, the more you'll feel it, unless you spend a lot of time, kind of paying attention to your body. But I'll tell you an interesting story about it. So I was with my partner. We went and visited her grandmother and her aunt, who had recently had a stroke, who was bound to a wheelchair. And I had one of these units with me. And I thought to myself, wow, this girl hasn't been out of the wheelchair in years now. When was the last time she had her feet on the ground? Maybe grounding would be nice for her. I said, would you like to try this device and see what happens? She goes, sure. I said, okay. And I gave it to her. She put her hand on it. And about a minute later, she goes, oh, my vertigo's gone. I'm like, oh, I didn't know you had vertigo. Is it possible that it's just gone because it comes and goes on its own? She goes, nope. When it comes, it's here for hours and it just turned right off. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. She goes, yeah. And so she's using it. And about 5 minutes later, she takes her hand off the device. And she just forgets about it. And I put it back in my pocket. And a few minutes later, she goes, the vertigo's back. I'm like, oh, well, do you want to try the unit again? She goes, sure. I said, okay, well, do me a favor. If the vertigo goes away, tell me when. And so she puts her hand on it. And I'm counting in my head. And when I get to 40 seconds, she goes, oh, it's gone. I said, oh, that's great. And so conversation goes. 5 minutes later, she forgets about it, takes her hand off. A few minutes later, the vertigo comes back. I said, oh, do you want to try it a third time? She goes, please. I said, okay, again, if it goes away, please tell me when. And right at 40 seconds, again, it turns off. So the vertigo turned off and on three times. Now, obviously, most people are not going to have such a dramatic experience, but she had a heavy brain injury. So for her, it was dramatic. For me, it's more just like, I feel like I breathe deeper. My body feels more relaxed. I feel a little bit more present. You know, that's what it feels like to me. But I do it not so much because how I feel, although I do like how it feels, but also because I understand conceptually that we're all meant to be in a state of constant healing. And, you know, just breathing oxygen burns the body. You know, there's toxins in the environment, there's EMF coming from this. I mean, there's all these things that are challenging from the body, but then there's this one thing the earth gives us, this gift of healing. And if you're not grounded, you're not getting that gift. And I wanted it. Continue. So, and I wanted others to have it. So I made the unit.
That's cool. And what is that called?
I call it the portable electron charger. I guess I wasn't very inventive with the name that day.
That's interesting. Yeah, I'd like to give that a try. That's great. Spencer, is there any, we've been going for a while now. Is there anything else you want to touch on?
Yeah, I'd like to leave with a note of hope. You know, there's a lot of people who are out there who are chronically ill and they've been that way for a long time. Maybe it's getting worse. They've gone to a lot of different doctors, and other than spending a small fortune, they haven't had much help. And what I want to say is, you know, don't give up hope. The body has an amazing capacity to heal. And, you know, I'll give you a final example. There is a woman who called me up. She was like 75, and she called me to thank me because her headache was gone. She took Clitamins and she said her headache was gone. And I said, oh, ma'am, I'm very glad your headache went away. She goes, no, really. It was a bad headache for a long time. Thank you. I'm like, well, what's a long time? She goes, 40, 50 years. She had a headache. She was like 16, nonstop. Now, a trapped gallstone can cause headaches. So I think this woman might have had a trapped gallstone for 50 years and it finally went away. Now, granted, you know, it would have been nice if she had been pain-free much earlier, but at least she got to spend the last few years of her life out of pain. So what I'm saying is, hopefully it doesn't take someone 50 years, but, you know, don't give up hope. If you're struggling with something, keep thinking, keep looking, keep experimenting. The body is amazing at healing. There's so many people out there working to try to figure out how the body works and how to make it work better. Just have faith that if you're in a rough spot now, just have faith that, you know, healing is always possible.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And thanks for mentioning that. The body, there's some infinite wisdom and we don't even understand it all, but it is always moving towards homeostasis. Sometimes we just got to get out of the way and give it a little extra support. And it looks like you spent a lot of time on that and you created some products that could be really helpful. Another tool in the toolkit for people to access. Spencer, I want to thank you for taking the time and chatting with us, giving us the 101 on detox and other things. I really appreciate it. And for the listeners out there, always grateful for your listening. And I hope you learned something today. And I hope everyone has a terrific day. Well, thanks again, everybody, for listening. I do appreciate you tuning in. And like I said in the beginning, please don't take this as medical advice. But if you do feel like you're having a tough time and you think it might be because something that you need to kind of cleanse your body of, I do recommend you reaching out to somebody that is skilled in that field and having some guidance in hopes to avoid some of the mistakes that I personally have made by just being a little too quick to try something. I currently am trying some of Spencer products. So far, so good. It's fairly early, so it's a little early to say, but nothing bad yet. And I'm looking forward to see how it unfolds. Thanks again. I hope you got some value out of this, and I hope you have a great day.